Welcome to Trout Stories. I'm Lenny Fontana coming out of New York City. Couple of things. We're in the middle of the winter. And when they say brick cold, man, it's brick cold. 22 degrees Fahrenheit, -5 on the Celsius side. Whoa. But the wonderful part about winter is it tucks us back into our homes. And this is the time when we watch all these wonderful programs and catch up on things, because normally we're out and about when it's getting warm out, dancing, partying in the streets. And this is why I'm going to go this direction to a movement that happened. Coming out of the 80s into the 90s, a movement that became strong, a movement that couldn't be played with, a movement that was helped and created by this man that I'm about ready to bring up. And when we call him a godfather of a sound, we must use it eloquently. And when I say it, I mean it. Godfather of UKG. What in the hell is UKG? UK Garage. A sound that was born off of the American sound coming from the shores of New York City, New Jersey, Chicago, but then taken and made its life and home in England. This wonderful man, activist, he is smart as a tack. Don't kid yourself. He's always on the pulse. He's looking for the next thing. But we have to talk about part of his past too, because without the past, we wouldn't have the present and what the future is going to be. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the show my brother man, who I have broke bread with at a table in his family's house, have ultimate respect for as an artist, a DJ, producer, remixer, promoter, you name it. You know, when you talk about changing hats all day long, this man does it. For you, up to this stage, Norris, the boss, Windross.
Too much. A little bit too much. I mean, a little bit too much.
But hey.
You earned it.
Yeah.
You got the stripes. You got the stripes on your shirt to prove it, bro. And the years of experience to go off of. I know you don't want to hear it. I know you're very modest. And that's another thing I should have mentioned. He's also too modest, and that's dangerous for all of us, because he's lethal with so many ideas, so much chutzpah in him that he still has a lot more to say. He's not through yet. Now I'm done. Norris, how are you?
Yeah, thank you. Interesting listening to someone such as yourself. Thank you. And with the stripes you have, introducing me. So thank you, and hello everyone.
Brother, yeah. Man, you know, a lot of years have gone past, and with the years comes wisdom.
Yes.
You know, I talked about this with other people and other shows about scenes and sounds, but there's not many people that I could say are a primary source to a sound, or in the beginning there was Genesis. You know what I'm saying? We got to talk about like that Genesis part, and you are part of that Genesis. You're the beginning, the alpha to the beta. You know, it is what this is. Can't take that away from you. They can rewrite it the way they like to, but the story always sets back to you. So how, before we even get into the story of the UKG, we want to hear the parts of you growing up and finding the music. So how does music find you as a young kid?
Three letters or five letters or six letters, however you want to call it. It's got to be mum or mummy. Yeah. It's got to be that little Grammy in the corner of the living room that we're not allowed in. Well, we are allowed in. We are allowed in on Sundays, actually, and we can go in there and put the 7 inches and rack them up. My mum would encourage me to rack up 5 or 6 records, and it would go around and they would drop. And Sundays were a very special thing in our household outside of Sunday school when that stops, but because none of us like that. But when we were back, or when before we were going, that gramophone seemed to be the biggest sound system in the world to me. And my mum's love of music was very eclectic. Of course, we had the reggae, the Trojan hits playing, and the Israelites and all that. But we also had Tom Jones. I remember my mum used to call everyone that she fancied her boyfriend and put my boyfriend's record. It's not unusual. So, yeah, I mean, it's, and because of her joy in the music, I felt the same joy from the music. And that was the start of it. As it happens, we were in our house in, I mean, this was, I mean, from a very young age, we didn't have the gramophone. But when we got out of the real bottom part and moved up to the council house part, and had what I've described as a castle, although it was just a 2 up, 2 down. And we were in there, and I felt that was it. That was all of us. But my mum and my dad split up before I was 5, and we moved from North London, from South London to North London. And she told us which she was opening the pub. She was actually opening a club, a nightclub. It was called the Cobweb Club, infamous in North London. We had a lot of the big sound systems pass through. Fat Man was kind of like resident there, but we had Shaka in there. We had loads of people come and hook their boxes up there. As such, as a 9/10-year-old, 11-year-old, I used to sit on lamps, play, watch them. They taught me to play dominoes and listen to them chatting, their yard chat, and having a love for the bass line. I just remember developing this great love for the bass line, although ultimately I became a soul boy because I love soul music. So that was me. That was me. That was it. It's like,
there's no better education than being in mom's club. But I mean, there's nothing better than that.
Yeah. Well, it's,
when you say about DJs and things that were coming through selectors, was it more of a reggae style club?
It was a extreme reggae club. It was a sound system club. So she opened it and it was just reggae. I mean, real reggae, roots reggae, like Mike Men, they'd string their boxes up. I think the club, I thought it was huge, but maybe 250 people could fit in that basement. Very low ceilings, rocked the place. We was upstairs in the bedrooms when they were doing it, but when they were stringing up, I was party to, as I say, to sitting on laps, watching them do their thing. Like I say, that's where I think listening to the sounds from upstairs in the night times, and literally back then, the club would be Friday, Saturday nights would go through to 4, 5, 6 in the morning. So it was lawless, really. But
when mom was running the club, who was the impaler upstairs keeping everyone in line? Who was the, you know, parochial person, I should say, you know, well, parent?
We looked up, we were trusted. Don't know why she'd done that, but we were upstairs alone. So come 8, 9, 10 o'clock, we were banished to the upper floors. That's everything down to the ground floor. It was like a 3-story house on the high road. Quite a big house, still there. Walked my son past it the other day and told him about it again. And we looked out for ourselves. We wasn't meant to be in bed, but we used to play games. We used to run down. We used to listen. We used to try not to get caught. We used to call it spiff spying. But we wanted to be as round the sound as much as possible. The three of us, Rosemary, my little sister, and Beverly, my older sister. And got some great memories, great fun. outside of the rest of it.
That this is, I see, I knew none of this part. This is incredible. That you
guys, this is, this is news to most people.
Immersed in nightclub life as a kid, without even knowing you're immersed in nightclub life.
Yeah.
But let me touch on something. Mom and dad split up, okay?
Yeah.
Did she come from a nightclub background, Mom?
No, she come from church background.
So how does this go on to become a nightclub owner?
Well, she met a guy that was in our lives for a few years, and I suppose it was their relationship that brought it, because it was his idea. It was between them. My thoughts on him ain't the greatest thoughts, but actually it was him that encouraged the move, and my mum went along with it, and she became a licensee, and rest of his history, as we so to speak.
Yeah, so it's like you never know what karmically is going to happen when other people come into your life. I mean, who would have thought? I can't ask you, hey, if you didn't go into this type of lifestyle and work, what would you be doing now? Because it's kind of pre to you even being in a position to be like, well, I've never dealt with that as a kid. And then I found it later. You were already immersed in it as a child.
That's right. That's right. It's like, well, immersed in music forever, and not having the aspiration for it ever, can tell you that much. There was a, inside me, I suppose I was just looking to find whatever I was in amongst the emotions and feelings that I felt then. But music was always not an outlet for me, but solace. I find solace in music. So we used to have to clean the nightclub on Saturdays. It wasn't easy life. On Saturday mornings, me and my little sister would have to go down into the cellar and actually remove all the bottles, mop the floor, sweep the floor, hoover the floor, change the bar. It was that small. But in that, we were allowed to turn the music on, and whatever records were down there that my mum had down there.
So we're talking, just to be clear on this, we're talking about the Miss Ross, Rose.
Rose Windross, that's right. Sure. Yeah.
So these two together were doing the cleanliness of the club.
Yes.
And then on top of it, due to force majeure, playing music.
There was a big piano down there in the back as well. We taught ourselves to play some tunes on that. I remember we'd mess about quite a lot, obviously, because my mum was sleeping. We'd be down there having the run of the downstairs, including the bar, by the way. It was naughty stuff. And we would do some chores, play some music, play the piano. Found some loves of certain artists. Rosemary fell in love with the stylistics. I remember she just like started collecting their records from young. So,
Who was musically trained on the piano to play?
No, we taught ourselves.
Oh, so you?
We taught ourselves to pluck tunes out. Neither of us could play as such, and neither had us had training or lessons or anything. But we taught ourselves to do the simple tunes and find chords and that. And I suppose we must have developed musical ears without the rest of it, if you know what I mean. So Rosemary went deeper into the music earlier, much deeper. So she threw herself into trying to understand it, to use her voice and all that stuff. Hence she got a... She made an album when she was very young. When she was 16, she made a reggae album called Just Rose. I think it was number one in the Lovers Rock charts back then. But enough about her.
No, it's an important part about her. We love her. That's why we need to ask. Because she's entangled with you as much as I'm trying.
I've got to remember, I'm actually here interviewing about myself, but... If I can't, if I don't talk about the the stuff that the things around me that I remember well that made me. But again, like, I wasn't that interested in the music industry or DJing it much at the time. I was more interested in nightclubs. So by the time I was out from 12, 13, hitting nightclubs, hitting the Royal E, and like dancing and finding my own thing in music, which was literally just that soul sound, the early hip hoppy sound, what they call it, hip hop now, but maybe. But
we really talking about like Rapper's Delight type
of? Rapper's Delight. They appeared at Southgate in Royal. It was called the Royalty. Froggy was a DJ there, and he was an amazing DJ. Right up front club. It was really up front with its music, and that's what I got immersed in, that soul sound.
And that's why I'm asking those questions, because in order to understand the road that you're on now, somewhere along the line, Froggy came to New York in the middle of the disco era. Froggy hung out with Larry Levan, brought that what he learned here or shown, brought it back to England with the Froggy sound system. We went from city to city around. I guess that sound system thing was a big thing back then. And a lot of people I've interviewed from the UK always talk about those sound systems and what they did and the change. Because I guess there was nothing like that prior to that, right?
I mean, there was, from when I was young, the first thing I knew about sound systems was the reggae thing. So let's have it completely straight. The sound system itself belongs, it's a Jamaican thing. It's a create your own boxes, make the bins and make the bass, and everything was about getting as much energy out of those systems as possible. And that's why they call them sound systems. I think the soul thing was more clubs, was not so much systems, although there were systems that were playing across the board. That, because the other thing about back then is, outside of the illegal stuff, the shebeens and that, there weren't no late licenses for clubs. So people were hooking up systems in houses and emptying the houses out. And then you'd have the different systems in different areas. And you find the ones that had the bigger followings. And come carnival time, that's when they rocked most, you know. And I remember Under the Bridge, I'd go down there and just stand and listen to the music and feel the vibe. That's what it was all about.
I've done research, and they've shown in the Jamaican reggae that stuff goes back to the late 40s and the 50s in Jamaica with the sound systems on the street. They would set those things up. It wasn't something that just happened in the 60s, late 60s, 70s. They were already doing that in Jamaica for a while. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
So give it up to the Jamaicans. You know, yeah. The Caribbean was, you know, the sound system selector, and it was one turntable, not two.
That's it. That's it.
Record. That's,
yeah.
Brim like, to brim, right?
Even today, the one sounds, the one turntable, they created effects boxes themselves. So all those, all of that is a Jamaican legacy, you know, sound system legacy. So, yeah. And I'm proud to say I come from that.
Damn right, boy, you should be proud. That's a very good legacy. And I know that I experienced that in the earlier part of the UKG sound when I used to go out, because I would be, let's put it like this, I'd be playing in the other room, and I would go into the room at the Coliseum, for example, and the UKG, and you'd hear those sounds from Jamaican reggae slipping into UKG sounding records, and also effects and stuff, that horn sound and all that stuff. It was kind of to get the crowd ecstatic and excited. But enough of that. We'll keep going on your journey. So Froggy and them, of course, you're going out. Hip hop is becoming the first part of the legacy of the, what we call the dance golden path that you're on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That when I was in the clubs, at my, I'd say at the height of me being in clubs was 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. Obviously I stayed in the clubs 21, 22, 23, but But those times I was just like I worked and I went out to nightclubs. That's all I'd done.
But you got to explain to people why. Was there anything else at that time? Was there computers around? And was
no,
there
no.
And, you have and to that, tell people the, what the life was like at that time.
Well, life at that time was it was you go to the club. Virtually all clubs when I was that age were done by 1 o'clock in the morning. That was late. You'd either get bus or tube or whatever you got home. If you wanted to stay out, you'd walk the street literally and just listen for the music and gatecrash, because there used to be so many street parties back then. The music was it was eclectic. It was soul based, but it was eclectic. You'd hear everything through the night. I remember African Bambaataa tunes, the Soul Sonic Force tune. When it first came out, it destroyed the place. And definitely affected hard with that electro sound as well. That's what I lived for. I had the mother of my big kids. I was with her from 16, but we were young, you know. Nothing was that solid to me, if you know what I mean. We were just together a long time. She gave me my two oldest children, and I love her to death for that. And if I'm honest, my children that changed my life around, but that took me away from music, if you like, because from that I thought I've got to look after my young family, and went down the straight path and didn't go out as much, and realized that I was a bit sharper than I thought I was. And I got into the life of sales because I wanted to earn more money, and I realized, two twos, I started a company that was selling some stuff, carpet cleaning as it was, and then that didn't work pan out, and then I got into selling double glazing, and that seemed like earned some good money, better money than I would have done when I left work at 19, and it was just about providing and for me and my young family at the time, and that was my identity. I believed that was my identity anyway. And
were you even playing around with DJing yet at that time?
Not at all.
So you were just total clubber and just
clubbing, living life at home. I was more living life at home at the time, I bought a house by the time I was 24, and just settled, and I thought that was going to be me. But what brought me into the clubs, into the raves, and this is the transition, was around about 25, 26, I went through what I now know was a complete breakdown, meltdown, depression. I just didn't know what I was, who I was, why I was, caused the split up of me and Jackie, my wife. At the time, I felt like I was abandoning my children, and I got depressed. And just around that time, I'd been into the nightclubs, to that early acid house thing. And after a bit of this and that, it became a release for me, because I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have that release, because I was proper in a... at the bottom of the pit in my mind, you know. I will say that two things saved my life. Yeah, my daughter saved my life when she came when I was just barely 20, because she made me want to live for more than myself, because I didn't really care about living or dying at the time. I was just getting by, and I was hustling as well, and you know, didn't have the greatest respect for life, if I'm honest. So she made me want more.
Is that my kids?
I say her to start off with, her and my son Daniel. They made me want more for life, because I wanted more for them. And then when I realized I couldn't hang about for them, and that destroyed me, that's the thought. I couldn't hang about and be with my kids, even though my father had left me. And I left, and I was torn inside, and like I'm saying to you, I met some little fellas. They gave me a different different idea about life whilst I was raving with them, if you know what I mean. And I never grasped myself, by the way. but I found house music. I found acid house music initially, which I didn't like too much. But when that vocal house music started giving those messages of positivity and hope and vibration, Free at Last, you know what I'm talking about, the early era. I think that was the next thing that saved me from it gave me something to stop me from thinking about myself, for sure. And I threw myself into raving virtually full time. The time span from that would have been from 88, 89, when I got on it hard, 88, 89, 90, the music and the genres that happened in that space of time it felt like something new was coming. It was changing. It was evolving. It went from like eclectic, bit of this, bit of that, to over air anyway. From the fields into the clubs, and in the clubs you've got these different sounds, some harder. I can't tell you how many different names or genres come around. And I realized that the genre of music that I loved listening to was disappearing amongst, especially on my side where I was going. And what was coming was the hardcore, which I liked the early stuff of, but the hardcore, and which ultimately turned into the jungle drum and bass, those things, neither of which were my thing, just a little bit too fast for me. I loved the best music of it, but didn't want to be in the clubs with it, if I'm honest. And really I'd been dabbling with the decks by then, by the way. I've been dabbling with a crew of people around with decks, and I bought my first decks. And in early 1990, I wanted to do something myself and put something on that I'd like to go to. So we looked for a little club on a night where I didn't have no competition to go out and or anything, because I did need to go out, did need to be about it, because I was a bit of a face then and couldn't stop going out. But I thought, if I do something on a Tuesday or Wednesday for myself, like 200 club with some people. And that's what I've done. Started a night called Yum Yum. And I think that was early 91 when we started that. And we just started playing Strictly Rhythm, I believe, was launched about then as well. And a bunch of other labels were coming. And that's the type of music we played. Because Strictly Rhythm gave a lot of music in a short space of time.
The American house sound was the beginnings of the Yum Yum sound of that club.
That's
right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I mean, Love Dancing and tracks like that destroyed our club. Crystal Waters destroyed our club. It's like Eric Morello's Dancing and. Some of those early tunes, but that's what we was on. And there were other people on it as well. There was the Lyndon C. We knew each other well, Ricky Morrison and that. But what I think what distinguished Yum Yum from maybe that other UK house and garage sound is we played the music a bit faster, and maybe we were a bit more raucous than we weren't that smooth, if you know what I mean. We were more street. That's and more hard.
That's a question I've always wanted to ask. Why did you play it faster than music?
I felt it made people want to dance. Bet more harder. Do you know what I mean? I felt it was like I love the personally. It was about the beat, the bass line, and the melody. Yeah, and when I say the melody, I don't mean the song. I mean the melody. The if you could get hooks going over and over again, that's why we tended to play, unless the song was big, like Crystal Waters and that. But generally speaking, we were on that hooky thing. You got me, la. Oh, what a tune. You got me, la. Dum, 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 and the drums. So you play that a bit faster. Rather than plodding, you were bouncing, you know. You were like, well, that's what I felt from it anyway.
And so that changes, yeah, because I'm going to guess other aspiring young DJs are in the crowd watching you all play behind the decks, and they're feeling the vibe and they're seeing what's going on around them. And of course, others start to copy, you know, that.
And that would have been because like 91 to 93, 94, I mean, I started making my name as a DJ in 91 because of that. And people started booking me, you know, elsewhere, which come out of the blue for me, because it wasn't the ambition for me to be a DJ. But people started booking me, I suppose, because of the vibe that we had in the club. And hoping that we get some of the people from our club to follow me down there. So I started playing for people that maybe needed more people in their clubs.
Sure.
But then I've got to say that the other thing that we had a crowd that was maybe a little more hard to deal with than just your straight up party goer, if you know what I mean. So
okay, so, hang on, brother man. So sell me on this idea. You are as the promoter / DJ, you walk into someone's room and you bring in this crowd and you know what you're dealing with, because you know, like you said, it's a bit of a harder crowd. They're not your glitzy handbag crowd, let's put it nicely.
I think you got that. What it was there were raves and there were clubs, and there was your smoother type clubs, and then there was, and it's not that they weren't, because they wore their the girls wore their handbags if they were there, but it was just that, let's say, I'm just gonna say it straight, it was more road orientated people that come from maybe not working and doing other things, to, you know, people that were capable outside. They were like, if you know what I mean.
Well, let's make everybody talking from a New York side. So if we're running a club here, we would have gangsters, drug dealers, all kinds of the...
They're salt of the earth, right? You know? And they were...
I'm not putting them down. They got a party too.
And they could be out all the time. And I suppose House and Garage... UK Garage as it is now, but House and Garage as we called it back then, this side of House and Garage was that. It was a bunch of that lot of people, us lot of people, whatever you want to call it. And we loved to party. That's it. It was like, it was our release. We didn't want to bring the road into the club. We left the road outside and brought the, like you say, and brought the money and bought the clothes. We bought that stuff, and the girls come along because the music was bumpy. But it was your darker light characters, if you know what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Society doesn't allow these type of people to party comfortably and relax in this environment. You could be who you want to be, and no one's gonna mess with you.
There you go.
Because the music is all about the music.
Yeah.
And those that know, do not cross that line, because you do not want to deal with what's coming with at you in another minute.
Well, if I'm real about it, there were situations that gave the sound itself a bad reputation, because things could happen and things could kick off, and things did kick off quite a lot. So it's not all every venue, but you know, it only has to happen once to give you a bad reputation. And I suppose a lot of us that were deep in the scene started garnishing that reputation. I stopped getting booked for the money pennies and the gate crashers after a while, because you get associated, right?
And why did you get stopped booking? Because they didn't want the element that comes with the music.
And the element that sometimes comes with the music is...
And it happened in America. It happened here as well, because with the, as you guys were doing that, while we were having our big house events and underground, like a shelter or sound factory, the same time, you had hip-hop parties. And in hip-hop parties come gunfights, stabbings, killings, and it's loads of money rolling around. But the element of, oh my God, if I bring this crowd in, I may not have a club.
That's right. Well, we couldn't get clubs. That's the point of the matter, that a lot of the element that was building our sound, we couldn't get a club. We couldn't get a club for our thing for love nor money on a Saturday night. We started getting Friday nights when Friday nights started becoming a little less harder to fill, because we did have the crowds. We had the strong 400-500, and they were spenders. And so what we tend to do was take the clubs when other people wouldn't take the clubs. So Sunday became a big day for us. After parties on Fridays and Saturdays became, so the after party thing was big for us. And that's where we found our vibe. I mean, from my perspective, I didn't see what was going on elsewhere. But it was happening. It felt like all of a sudden there were DJs around that I didn't know until, and I thought, wow, okay, this scene is bigger than what I'm dealing with. This scene is, it's happening, and I don't even know it's happening. It was spreading. It had spread like wildfire, if you know what I mean. The sound and the scene, and it was slightly different here and there, but. Yeah.
Would you say your Sunday party was the most important part in the early days?
I'd say I wouldn't. In the early days, I'd say it was the after party, but Sunday became a day for house and garage, because no one else was doing anything on those days. So some of the legendary nights happened in those times, daytime on Sunday, nighttime on Sunday. So daytime on Sunday, nighttime on Sunday, leading to sometimes daytime on Monday. It was a very after party thing, because like I'm saying to you, a lot of the crowd weren't your average Joe worker needing to get up 9 to 5, you know? So.
Yeah, so then didn't matter. It doesn't matter when you have that kind of situation.
We can put on parties and have people turn up, because and then eventually, you know, it started swelling to normal people coming to those parties as well. Moving forward to the Spread Love era, when Dominic took over the Gas Club, and then Timmy was doing Happy Days originally, and Frog and Nightground, and the Elephant Castle, and all these different people were finding these different places. It's like Alan had EC1 on a Sunday night in the early days. Locations on a Sunday. These are names that only those that know will know, but these were the places that built, that put the foundations in for.
So at that time, Norris, how big would you say the parishioners were of this scene? Like you know, you're spreading out 5, 6, 7 clubs now. How big is the scene at this time, you think?
So I'd say anywhere. Like there was one stage where I actually felt it was 500 strong. It wasn't that I counted, but I reckoned we would fill clubs. We could fill Cat de Paris, for example, on a Sunday daytime. Someone was doing it on Sunday daytime, and it would be chocker. It'd be really busy in there, and it held 600 people. And I'd know basically virtually, at least by sight, most of that 600. You know, it would be the same. And then I'd go another place, and I'd know most of the people there. So I used to say 500 strong. For a little while, big up 500 Records, by the way, and But then I don't know when, because then I realized, right, it's bigger than that even. It's like there's I don't know when it got to the 1,000 or 2,000.
Yeah, but something happens. Like I asked that to MC Creed as well. When does this I mean, okay. Let me rephrase that. Let me take it back for a second. Along the way of you DJing, when does the actual microphone selector MC guy begin to take place along with you?
So there were a couple of MCs that, and I would give this to the credit of MCs on Garage Sets. I'm going to give the credit to Dominic Spreadlove. He was the one that would constantly bring an MC, and it was through him that I met Chris Rarely as an MC. Anyway, we knew each other, but as an MC, why he's an MC? And I suppose it was just that's Spread Love on a Sunday, Gas Club, 1994, is when all of a sudden Chris's voice started becoming the voice of UK garage, the first garage MC, definitely for me, and renowned. And he'd do something that other MCs wouldn't do. He put some tones down that were just like, no one else was doing, was the way he'd done that, where doing it again, that would, he said that once and the club would go crazy. Anywhere you heard that, and so first that was one. And then,
brother, his voice is so distinct, nobody sounds like him. That's another thing. He knows how to rap, but
it's the deepness of his lyrics as well. So when he's not just typing, he's actually giving you some depth with the lyrics that he's talking about. He's doing it cryptically, but when you listen to his lyrics, it's out of the game.
So the explosion of that combination is where really this thing starts to take its own place in music history. You know, the rap, reggae rap sound with the beats. What's the first, would you say the first recording that comes out from the UK guys? That you say, you know, okay, example, Marshall Jefferson's House Music Anthem is a really big record. Okay. Yeah. That's when it goes overground. Like, what is that moment where you say, whoa, this is the record that changes the game?
What for UK, with an MC on it or for UK Garage?
What's the UK Garage sound? Because you guys are playing, you know, Masters of Work set up and all that stuff.
So when I started really taking the DJing thing seriously and realized, oh, it was like, we've got this thing here, you know? And like, I remember feeling like I had this feeling of pride that the way this thing had grown from what it was when I first recognized it to what it was at that time. And I realized I'm playing all over the place and I was watching my record box and it was predominantly US based, and then then it's like I actually took notice of the UK sound, and I'd be hearing the tunes in the shop, and basically it took a little while for me to begin to buy that stuff because I felt it wasn't for my ears anyway where it needed to be, but for other people it was what it was. But for me, there was a track by what's it called, my brain's gone dead with it now, absolutely dead. It's not the tune because Matt Jam Lamont and Justin Cantor made an early tune that killed and destroyed the clubs, which we all rated in. It was Feel My Love. I don't know. It was. I don't know if it got what label it was on, because he played it in the Gas Club once on a white label, and it had writing on it. And And I kind of like begged him for it. I said, give me it. And he gave me it.
Please give it to me. Please. Give it.
He gave me that copy there and then. And so I've still got that copy to this day. So that was a big track, Feel My Love. But what they call Gavin Mills and Brian Farms were in the studio at the time. They were the guys that got me in there. And they originally had someone called Nathan. I'm trying to remember what he went out as. And the track was called Over You, and it was very musical. Da, 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 da. Everything was built right until the bass line, dum, 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 dum. And like for me, that was a tune that carved the way for British sound as well. It's still 4/4, it's still trying to be American, but it had something more, as did the UK tunes and the American dubs now, because the accentuation was on the skip and was on the bass and the bounce. That's what started happening. When was Never Let It Go? That was still quite early still, that record, which is another one, because it wasn't British, but the two-step mix, which actually...
Right, that's another thing. The two-step thing started becoming more prominent, right?
Well, again, it was all happening quite early. So when I say so from 95, 96, it's like you had, Tina Moore was the emptiness and the organ and never let, dun, 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 dun. So it would kill the place. I couldn't believe. In fact, I still think it might be. I've still got whoever the producer is. Because I'm not sure who the producer is. I know what I read.
Yeah, but it was a lot of things like that back then. There's all these white labels running around, right?
Well, it was on a label and it said that someone had done it. But I just, every time I listen to record, I think I recognize the sounds as being someone else. But I'm not going to say it right now. But whoever done it, it destroyed the place. Then you had them too, that kind of like for me started really making the British two-step sound, called Destiny, the track called Destiny, which was killing it, 96. And then everything, I mean, I think a whole load of two-step stuff started flying in then and really taking over the hype funk tune in the UK clubs. And that's what, when I say actually the stamp of the UK sound was now here, what was driving the clubs. Although American, although you had those tracks that were coming in still from stateside, you had a lot of British producers and labels now coming up with a sound. Confetti, 500 Records. There's too many to mention. Probably. Myself, I made my first. I made my first tune. Well, it wasn't my first. I made a couple before that, but I made a tune with Gavin and Brian. It's called Funky Groove. Actually, I say I made a tune. You actually showed a tune called You Used to Hold Me to me earlier, which was I went into the studio with them, and we actually just, I brought some vinyls in and some ideas, and we just put down an EP, a little 7-inch EP to start off with. Then we done Used to Hold Me. Then we remixed one of the tunes called Funky Groove off the 7-inch, which became the one that actually put my name on the map as a producer, because it went out as Noise the Boss Windross, and it was just a little firing little dub, really. So
you've actually found your way into a studio without even pushing for that. That just sort of
someone. It was Gavin that said, "Come," because he loved my vibe on the decks. He said, "Let's get that vibe down on the record," you know. So let's get that vibe. So we worked together a couple of bits. I've got to say, going in with him gave me a bug. I bought a Mac. I bought him back after about 3 months and just started learning, number one, about Macs, because I didn't really know about computers at the time. So, and that thing, so I had to learn to build it and put it back together again with regards to programs and the and the how it all works, the structure and everything, and I started learning at the time. I actually bought, to start off with, Steinberg on the Amstrad. I've got it, still got it in the garage, with the dongle on that first little computer.
You sure? Is it called Amstrad or Atari?
No, Atari. That's it. Atari. I've got it in the computer. I still got it, my first one. So I bought that. I got one of them, and I had the Steinberg on it, the one where you had the dongle and plugged it in. Started learning Steinberg, but very soon after was when the Mac kicked in, and I thought I got to have one of them. So I got one of them with Cubase, and started learning to use it very badly. But
here's the thing: it's not like today where you just drag and drop, and everything is pre-made. Back then, you had to learn everything from the beginning and, like you said, build it.
It was like, yeah, you needed outboard. There weren't no plugins, so you needed outboard for the sound. You need to sort of plug everything in, understand how to work everything, and wire it all up. That was before I actually started realizing that actually I need some really good sound modules and what have you. So it became a hobby for me rather than work, because if I weren't DJing, I was partying. I weren't partying, I was being my daddy. Most of my time was taken up with other things.
Proper grafter. I was saying before, proper grafter.
Yeah.
But you know what? There's a lot of money rolling around too in that time as well in the UKG scene, because there's gigs coming in, there's places to promote. It's fresh, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, getting paid for the gigs, putting gigs on, getting paid for some of the music. It was an exciting time. It was very exciting time. But I can't talk about it in the way someone that had an ambition would talk about it, because I had no ambition. I was already doing more than what I thought I would be doing.
What do you mean you have no ambition?
I had no ambition.
I know that. Well, what does that exactly mean?
It means that I was already in a place that I loved, getting more than I thought I ever would, if you know what I mean, from something. It wasn't that I thought I want to be a superstar DJ, or I want to be here, or I want to be there. I was where I was, you know? And yes, you look around and you take it to the degree, you take advantage of the opportunities that are in front of you, but I didn't have no vision of what was next for a long time. I was just, this is wicked. This is great.
So you're just going through the flow.
I'm with the flow. That's what I was. That's what I was with. And appreciating it as well. My mindset was still pretty broken when it came to thoughts and feelings about myself, if you understand what I'm saying. So just to be there was magical for me. Somewhere that where I was getting, if you like, a certain amount of self-respect for myself, because I was doing something that I realized people appreciated and I appreciated. So I loved that. I loved the interaction of, and I still love the interaction of, wow, I can put a tune on, I can put another tune on, and I can mix. And I love mixing. I love that creation of a vibe within two tracks, and listening to the formulation of a new thing, and getting off on that energy, that creative energy, the vibe, the dance floor energy, the energy that I believe unites people, or can unite people. And that's my aim when I get on the dance floor. That's my aim when I write a tune.
I really feel like it's more with you, because I've been around you outside this music thing.
Yeah.
I feel like it's more like a person like yourself says, hey, come on in, make yourself comfortable, leave all your problems behind. We're going to just enjoy ourselves.
Yeah.
No strings attached.
Oh, lovely.
No inhibitions. We're not doing this for money.
Lovely.
We're doing this because we love what we do. Is that it?
Yeah. That's it. That's it. And then anything else is a bonus. Anything else is a bonus.
Okay. So now here's the questions now that come out of this. You're coming in with the non-intrinsic way. You're doing a course. You're making money. And this is love. Like it's like flower power. We love each other. When does the wars begin?
Not quite flower, but you know.
I mean, flower power meaning everybody.
Yeah, I know. I get you, but
everybody's super cool. Nobody's trying to kill each other.
Look, there's stuff out there, right? There is stuff out there, and I've got my stuff out there, as other people have got their stuff out there. But this is where I want to be. This is a place. This is a feeling I want to keep. And to bring forward, this is where I want to be. And that I've got out there, I'm trying to shut the door on it.
That's why
I don't mean family. I'm talking about the feeling of what can happen when you're out there being that thing, you know?
Yeah. Then how do you control the part that becomes the darker side of it?
Well,
out of your world. You know what I'm saying? But, how do you keep it?
Well, that's what I'm saying to you. It's keeping yourself in situations where that doesn't rear its head that much. But if you come from that, it's gonna come to you. It's like the vibration. We know what happens with it, right? It attracts. So it's just an evolutionary thing that as we've got older, that's around us less because it's in us less. That's it.
No, I get that. But but you know what, you're dealing with young people.
Well, we were young again. We were young, and look, I the things that I've seen, and the things I've seen happen, and recognize that. You know, they're not, it's like, it's this ain't a film out here, but it is a film out here, if you know what I mean. I ain't seen stuff with rose colored glasses. There's been lots of things that have gone on that have caused me to realize that, but that's where I come from. I don't come from a place that expects everything to be peaceful and good and everyone treating everyone with respect and no darkness can happen. I come from a place where darkness happens, you know?
Sure. Let me ask you this part. Now that we've gotten through this and through the 90s, and at the end of the 90s, I remember you guys, you and Creed and a few others created the
Jason, myself, Chris and Jason were partners, and that was one of my first big visions outside of what I was doing. And it was a vision that was born from appreciating that whatever this was that brought me to this stage of my life gave me an outlet that wasn't afforded to me. No one actually picked anything up and said, yeah, you have this, there's the route for you. It's something that we carved out somehow. It's something that was that I call it kick the doors off a little bit, because all of a sudden we're in the clubs, we're in where we want to be, and we're making dough, and we're creating our own, and we're destroying the nightclubs, and we're everywhere, but still we're not in that place that can actually say we're going to be here and be here continually. And looking at the US model of hip hop and how that went from where it was to where it is now, to where it is now today. And I thought, okay, and I worked it up in my head. I'm thinking, well, it's America's much bigger market than that and what have you. But if we can get ourselves up on stages, bigger stages, and we can get our artists on bigger stages, and we can encourage these one track writers to write albums, and maybe they can see themselves on stage doing tours rather than just singing in nightclubs, you know? And maybe we can be the promoters, right? And maybe we can make the records big. Right. And that's why that was the vision that for UKG, right? So not just doing a little awards ceremony in a little club, but to book a big stage, Hammersmith Odeon, it turned out to be the first one, and put the production in and actually get some A-list stars like at the time to present it, to give the awards away, and that's what we done with our own budget, you know. We didn't get that.
See, that's what I want people to understand. That yeah. You just said the magic words. You did it with your own money.
Yeah.
Self-proclaimed. It is what, you know, the vision wanted to come to fruition. And the only way to do it is you have to put up the money and all the passion that goes with it. And the pain.
And it was pain because it didn't make money. In fact, it took money. But we felt it was the foundation, you know, laying a foundation. And that, and the first one was successful. Everyone loved everyone. That the performance, I'm extremely proud of what happened. If we had social media at that time, it would have exploded. Forget what money we would have made then. We would have had all the footage on social media. It would have exploded. It was just a compot. But that was just before. It was like 2000, and not everyone would work. It's like I'd only just built my first website or had it built.
Yeah, nobody knew what that stuff was. It was like early
yeah,
days.
You know what I mean?
So, listen, you were working on fax machines on a regular landline.
There you go.
Thinking about
we did have emails, but that, and we did have downloads, but you didn't want to download nothing in those days. There's no doubt about that. So yes, we done that and we had it. We done the next year as well. We did get sponsored partially on the next year. We done it in Brixton Academy, and we were lining up year three. And it just felt like the bottom of the world fell out for us in late 2001. Because a lot of stuff happened around that time. It's funny when I look at that time, look at 9/11, and I look at what happened on our scene with all the bad press regarding particularly So Solid, with a shooting at Astoria at that time, yeah. And we were getting a lot of bad press, and the police were cancelling a lot of our nights, using the excuse that SH 101 gun crime squad was put together. There was a form that the clubs had to fill in to let them know that who was playing, and if certain people were playing, the police could pull the night. And from having all the clubs in all the urban venues in all the country, basically having Garage virtually every weekend, it virtually stopped overnight, and that's not even a joke.
Hit the brakes, right? So somebody hit the brakes.
I mean, it was astonishing. Like I would never have banked of that happening, being able to happen. But it was like someone just pulled the plug on it.
Do you really believe the shooting had that much pressure on?
I'm not going to say it was the shooting itself. I'm saying there was a bunch of things that happened all at once. The fact that they were tagging that there was a lot on the street. There was a lot of beef going on, and gun crime was at a height or getting stronger, and the things happened, like murders were happening. I'm just saying that straight, yeah, on the street, sometimes in clubs. And when they decided to take notice of it, mainly because we were getting, if the press on us was really good, i.e. the youth of the UK in the urban loved us, so we get good press most places in the magazines. But actually, then when the mainstream press, all they seemed to want to highlight was the worst things, and that's what killed it, you know.
Because what did you do to make up the difference? I mean,
there wasn't, for me, there was no making up the difference, because my whole career has been built around nightclubs, and that's it. No nightclubs, what am I going to do? Because I weren't a radio DJ. I've never been a radio DJ. Never had any ambition to play music in a radio station, if you know what I mean, or hadn't up until that point. My thing was just nightclubs. I was in the nightclubs. I was in the entertainment business, as far as I'm concerned. I wanted to put parties on or play at parties or be in venues. That was what was the love of my life, you know. So,
I mean, because that transition of, you know, financially and also your passion, your heart of entertaining, has been, as they say, the rug has been pulled out from under you. So now what? What did you do? You know, what did you do? Did you just say I'm done, or did you stick it out?
We're still making music, but that became harder and harder to be selling, because the music that we were making was not the darker energy music, if you like. And if I'm honest, and I only recognized this afterwards as well, because I'd been through one depression, I think I basically was making ends meet from 2002 to 2005, 2006, just doing it, playing here and there, doing bits and pieces, hustling, because that's what I am. I'm a hustler. I've been hustling all my fucking life, so I'm hustling to make money however I see. Oops.
So wait a minute. They're looking for his money.
How is that? Shut up.
They're looking for coins from you. Wait a second. Everybody's looking, because he's.
Yeah, that's what I am. Who's asking you to listen? Watch these phones, you know. Watch what you're saying in your house, because that's they're right. Listening. It's listening. Right. But I also realized I was depressed. I realized in about 2000 and end of 2005, 2006 that actually I'm depressed. I'm actually not what I admitted that to myself, and thought I've got to get myself in, got to get some help for this. And actually made an appointment to go and see my doctor and just say, you know what, it's like, I'm not 2 seconds. I'm not in my best of states, and I'm actually needing a bit of help here. And my doctor said, yeah, no problem. I can refer you, but that won't be for maybe 6 months or something. But in the meantime, he wrote me out a prescription, and I just thought, I'm not taking those tablets. I've taken other tablets for a long time, but I'm not taking those tablets, you know. So
you were self-medicating yourself on the street side.
Well, ever since I left my wife and kids, I've been self-medicating to get me through, if you know what I mean. So this whole rave thing was a self-medication. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean. And that's something that people don't really understand. They see us all happy, and they see the party atmosphere.
Yeah.
But when that music shuts off and you're alone and your mind starts to wander,
let me say, the thing that built this thing that I'm on was the party. And the vibe of the music helped that party. And we developed a group of us that I feel we were on the same level. And this group, and it might have been, I mean, maybe 60, 100 strong. Some would be there all the time. But at one stage in the early 90s, I'd say 92, 3, 4, 5, 6. You could make a phone call and find a party in someone's house at any time of the day. So some people would come back from what they were doing. Some of them worked and whatever. You say, call up. Well, what's happening? What's that? And we'd hold it around Angie. Oh, round noise now. And there was a bunch of places that regularly you knew those people would hold and have people in their house and music be playing, and the exchange of alcohol and whatever, and clothes and the sharing of things and really just being there in the music and the buzz, you know?
Sure.
That was a big part of my life.
Of course. And when that all stopped, now what do you have as advice?
Well, the thing is that all kind of like faded. So I'm not talking about, because come 1999, 2000, I was more professional then. It was like I recognized what we had around us, and it was trying to look for the way to sustain that, which is why the idea of UKG come along. I.e. the UKG Awards. By the way, it was UK Garage Awards. We branded it UKG, and a lot of people have got that now, say UKG as if it's the music, and it is related to UK Garage, but UKG is the brand that we created, and we stamp that with those big block capital letters with
UKG.
That's right.
Wow. Yeah. No, this is interesting. You know, this is, I'm just so glad you shared this part about, you know, your personal life, because again, nobody really ever talks about these things, that when the party stops, what happens?
Well, we hang on to life, right? Because if we can, we hang on to life, because I'm not even joking, Lenny. But I'm saying, my thoughts were dark. My thoughts for myself were dark, and I didn't want to be here. I didn't think that well of myself. The escapism for me was necessary for me to survive. And that's why I owe so much to it, because I don't think I would have survived, Lenny. I don't think I would have survived.
Does it go back to the situation when you were a kid, carrying all that with you along the way? You know, as we say, it's what we carry on our back.
Yeah.
You know,
well, if you want to take this to a deep place, it's like right now I'm 60, right? And all of that journey through my life, it's here where you realize the traumas that you don't know are traumas as a child, right? But they're traumas. And they turn you into whatever you turn into. And I recognize all the stages of my trauma and what actually happened. The consequence of my trauma was put me in a place where my mindset was, it wasn't forward thinking. It was survivalist. It was quite aggressive. It was protective. It was quite closed, like me and mine, you know. And I'm never saying I was a bad person, because I know I've never been a bad person wanting bad things, but I'm definitely was capable.
Of course. Things, you know, look, desperate situations drive you to do crazy stuff. We all know that. We've heard these stories from very famous people to people who are, you know, normal Joe.
There's no distinguishing. There's no normal either, by the way. They say normal Joe, but what's normal out there is that we've all got our demons, right? And that's what I'm realizing now. I'm at a stage of life now where I realize I'm extremely grateful for life. And I think I've been happy and content, but this gratefulness that I've got now, when I look back and I think, oh my God, I went through that to get here, and here I am, and I'm able to pass that on to my children. And I haven't done a bad job with children and grandchildren and family. It's where I now know that's where I've been most successful in the way through my feelings about myself. I've realize where the love comes from, where you have to inject energy to get your worth, you know, because without them, no me. And I mean that, without them, no me, without the music, no me, without my friends, without my really close friends, no me, no point. Yeah.
And let me give perspective. And there is none of these, without all these people, there's none of
no
us.
No me, no us. Yeah. Can't do it.
Once again, there's none of us without all these people that love what we do.
Yeah, that's it.
So, of course, all the years of the 2000s, you go through and you're hustling and bustling. When do you think to put back the band, as we would say, the machine, to fight back, to say, I'm taking what's mine again? You know, in a nice way, you know, I guess.
The last year or two, I've been on the right. What? Because the word is legacy now, right? So the last year or two, you know, what everyone knows what we went through in, well, I say the last year or two. No, I had a plan to do 20 years of UKG in 2020. And I had a venue all lined up and I was putting the resources together and the team together to help do that. Yeah. So we're going to do UKG 2020, a celebration of UK Garage. Yeah. And, you know, we all know what happened then. Everything changed. So that got postponed and what's going to happen. And they, and I don't know who they are, but the powers that be thought it best that they should send messages about that thing, and the messages caused families not to see each other and be fearful of seeing each other, not see grandparents and not see, and that wasn't me, I'm not saying that was me, but it affected some of my family, and actually it affected me seeing some of my family. And my road man just wasn't having that. I'm not having that. If it was a man or a thing, I would have attacked it and wanted to kill it without a blink, you know, because you're taking everything away from me that I love, you know, and you're doing it, and so I was got into researching and got into communicating with others that were questioning it, and we created. I created a couple of groups on some social things, and one of my pals, Alan, we spoke a lot. He's a very powerful guy, very committed, and very, when he puts his mind to something. And somehow a group called Together come out of it that we formed, and we became a voice for no lockdowns. We became a voice against the passports. We won some battles, we believe we did, with regards to mandates, and we have members now, and I'm extremely proud that I'm a founding member of that organization, still helping run it behind the scenes. Alan's driving it in front of the scenes, and we've got some really good, professional, committed people here still pushing against any of the I'm going to say bollocks, straight up. Any of the bollocks.
There you go, man. Straight up bull crap. Right
any
there.
Any of the bollocks that they're pushing on us these days as if it's true. We're challenging that now because we realise that actually we don't want autocratic states. We don't want technocratic states, draconian rules. We don't want to be told what to do unless something is really going on that's truthful. We recognise that some of these powers... some of these people that have these powers need to be held to account. And we believe the best way to do that is to get people to join together, metaphorically speaking, but join together, become a member. But if not, join together, because voices together make people hear better. You know, I'll go in front of 100 geezers and they'll look at me and they'll laugh. But let me bring my 100 and see what they do.
Right. You bring a gang of 100. Now see how that's going to be taken.
Yeah.
So out of things, negative things, actually positive things came out of that. Are you able to help change and help push along the
and,
way?
And still aiming to grow, that there's lots going on in the world that shouldn't be going on. It just shouldn't be. How can you judge? I'm growing as a young man, thinking actually they class me as a bad young man. I'm not good. It's like I'm not my energy is not good, and I'm not good for society because of what they've told me I am, and that's how I think of myself. And you've lied to all of us, because, and I say you've lied to all of us, I'm talking about the state has lied to all of us, because anything that any of the baddest of us are, we're that individually. What states perpetrate, you can't measure that. What they perpetrate against the populations on the planet, you can't measure that. And I'm going to leave that to everyone's imagination. But a state will perpetrate murder, ugliness, will allow starvation, genocide. I've done all those things states perpetrate. That's not me. I don't want to kill people, innocent people, for no reason.
No. You want to do this.
I want to bring people together. I want to bring myself together. I want to make myself better. I want to raise the vibration. I want to raise my vibration. I want to help people raise their vibrations. And I think the state should want the same for all of us. That same thing: raise our vibrations, make us be ruled by example. You know, not the rest of it.
Bring love together like this.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
Bringing you know. Or everyone together. And I get that, because being isolated does not clinically help anyone.
Well,
we've learned that the hard way, haven't we?
I think what I'm saying is that me, myself, I'm now not judging myself against the measures of the past, that where I'm realizing actually that was because of my environment, my situation, why I made those hard choices. But if you've given anyone chance to have a good environment and good situation, that's going to make the world a better place. No, so why are we letting those environments exist, even? Why are we as a whole, as a group, allowing for those environments to exist? We should be changing it.
Yeah, of course. But you know what? You know how hard it is. One voice alone can't do much.
No, but what one person can do, and this is where you are, this is where you wear the wisdom of the ones before, where you say you change the world by changing yourself, right? Michael Jackson tells you, look at the man in the mirror, yeah? And you just look for the wisdoms that you know to be true. And actually reject the bollocks that isn't.
I think a lot of us have learned that lesson. And like I said, again, during that period of time, gave everyone that moment of the pause to look at themselves in the mirror and really ask those important questions. What is really going on?
Yeah.
Marvin Gaye says it, what's going on? You know, it doesn't hold in 1970, it holds in 2024. It'll probably be the same in 2074. We're no longer here. It's what's going on.
So you just named my, if I named a tune, it would be that tune. Someone, one of my youngers asked me just two nights ago, he said, like, what tunes really move you? And what I think he said, what three tunes? And I said, let me say this for a start. A man like me can't name three tunes. I can name one tune that stands a little bit above everything else, and that would be what's going on for the message in it. It moves me like that. But I couldn't do any more than that. I could name you 150 tunes. I could possibly name you 200 tunes, and I would be upset that I never named you the other 200, if you know what I mean. So that's how much music is.
No, I hear you, Norris. And on the end note, as you've taken us on this journey, and thank you for, you know, sharing with us the clinical sides of you as well, and activist sides, we take off our hat to you. Where do you see yourself from now to infamy?
legacy is the most is the word that I've got in my heart, and my head, and my purpose. So I'm going to look to build on the foundations that have been laid in all departments. I'm gonna try and do what it is I preach to do, which is come together with as many like-minded, great energy people, and find ways to enrich self first and all around self. And whilst doing that, learn to share, learn to actually care more. But I'm in a great space already. So for me, that's already happening. I just want it to happen more and more. That's what I want for the world. More of that.
So people,
what should... I want myself, I've that's... got, that's what I'm trying to say. What I want for my, what I want for my, me and my family, I'm going to get. What I want for the world, I aspire to. Yeah.
I have to leave it there. Everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. One of our best selectors of the game has laid it from inception to infamy. And God bless the journey that you are on, because even the clinical part is so hard for people to speak about. And that's been something, as when we all grew up, we didn't have help at all back then. It was none of this. They were like, tough it out, man. Right? You know blank, what I'm talking about. Tough blank, it out. Like, tough
blank,
it out.
Blank canvases for us all. Like, work, yeah. Work that shit out for yourself, bruv.
Work it out, man. What do you think you're the only, what do you think you're the only one dealing with? It's the truth. What do you think you're the only one dealing with? But yeah. Now, thanks to awareness, vigilance, we can, and people like yourself that have the wisdom of carrying that to share it, you may have just helped someone stop themselves from doing something they should not be doing. And on that note, thanks again, everyone, for tuning in to True House Stories, where we always get the real story. This man right here, God bless him on his journey. He's got more to give you as time goes on. Keep an eye on Norris DeVos Windross. Take care, everyone. Thank you again.